You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, many of us remember learning about American history back in school, but maybe not about the history of our own hometown. We'll learn about a project in Neenah that's getting local history into the classroom. First, we take a look at new findings from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel showing Russian efforts to incite racial tensions during the Sherman Park riots in Milwaukee 2 years ago. As a result, there have been calls for a federal investigation from bipartisan sources, including former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, Governor Scott Walker, and Senator Tammy Baldwin. Jason Stein is a state capitol reporter with the Journal-Sentinel. He's one of the reporters who broke this story. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, we keep hearing about the Internet Research Agency and these other Russian actors who are behind these phony Twitter accounts and things like that. How did you trace the story now to what was going on in Milwaukee a couple years ago?
Well, it was not easy to do because although Twitter has identified thousands of these accounts and a couple have also been identified by special counsel Robert Mueller in his federal investigation, Twitter has removed the text of these tweets and suspended the account, so you can't get the information in the normal way you could get a tweet. But thanks to NBC News, published, I think, last month, an archive of hundreds of thousands of these tweets sent by these Russian-linked accounts. And, we searched those and found this troubling pattern of Russian actors using police shootings both in Milwaukee and around the country as opportunities to spread hate and disinformation.
And take us back now to the summer of 2016 and give us the backdrop for this, the police shooting and the riots that followed. Set the stage.
Correct. So there's a police shooting on August 13th, 2016. This is just a few months before the election in which Donald Trump won Wisconsin and the Electoral College. Then later that day and into the early morning hours of August 14th, there was chaos, unrest in the Sherman Park neighborhood in Milwaukee. Buildings were burned, gunshots were fired, people were injured, millions of dollars of damages. And within hours of that unrest, these Russian accounts sought to spread, racial tension and inaccurate information about what was happening.
Yeah, talk about, give us a sampling of the kinds of messages that we were seeing and not knowing they were from a Russian source.
Correct. So these would be messages such as claiming that Black Lives Matter activists were plotting to kill members of the National Guard. I mean, the National Guard was activated to be ready, but was never deployed to Sherman Park or to Milwaukee, so that would, could not have happened. There were other, statements that were trying to mislead people, and we saw some of these same statements are made after other police shootings around the country, and you see this very cynical attempt by these accounts to, on the one hand, anger people about Black Lives Matter and activists on that side, but also other accounts were seeking to spread disinformation about the police. One shooting out of state claiming that the victim had been shot in the back by police when that was not what the autopsy showed.
Talking to Jason Stein from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel about a report he worked on Russian social media, Russian-backed fake social media accounts, and how they reacted to a Milwaukee police shooting and unrest in the city that followed. A common theme, Jason, in this story anyway, a lot of these Russian accounts retweeted David Clark, then sheriff of Milwaukee County.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So there was certainly an attempt in many tweets to either amplify the voices of conservatives like Sheriff Clark or to direct criticism at Democrats, in the run-up to the election. So, noting that Milwaukee, putting out crime statistics about Milwaukee, noting it had been run by Democrats for a long time, that sort of thing. And then elsewhere in the state, you also saw the accounts promoting the then primary challenge to House Speaker Paul Ryan by a Janesville candidate, Paul Neylon. So, you know, a lot of mischief being done sort of across the political spectrum.
And one of the most famous fictional Twitter accounts was 10_GOP, which a lot of people looked at and thought it might be an official voice of the Tennessee Republican Party, or at least a Tennessean who was a proud Republican, turned out to be one of the most prolific Russian fake Twitter accounts, and 10GOP was part of this Milwaukee story.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very active in the Milwaukee incident. And that Tennessee GOP was actually named in Robert Mueller's indictment. It's one of these internet research agency accounts that was managed out of an office building in St. Petersburg, Russia. You know, sent out a number of tweets about the unrest in Sherman Park. You know, so those tweets collectively got thousands of retweets. And one thing we noticed is that, you know, if at least one or two of the messages used in Milwaukee, they recycled those messages and used them after other police shootings. They just changed the hashtag. And, you know, so in the sense that they were, you know, very cynically manipulating these events, seeing, you know, which messages, you know, resonated with people, worked people up, got them angry about, you know, I guess in some cases their own neighbors. And then, you know, when they had a similar event happen in a different state, they would deploy those same messages that had worked for them before.
And Jason, getting a little bit to the business of journalism and how you did this, I mean, I assumed you were just looking at Milwaukee in particular, but then you branched out and compared other messages in other cities and other shootings?
Right. And it was almost by accident that, you know, I went back to find one of the messages in the database that I had looked at before. And, you know, when I did a search for a couple of those terms, you know, I noticed that it brought up a almost identical tweet, but one that was slightly different and, you know, aimed at another state. And so then that got me, you know, looking to see, you know, how far had they taken this, you know, how systematically were they doing these tactics? And it turns out, you know, very cynically, very systematically.
And Jason, Russian hackers or Russian fake Twitter trolls didn't invent racial disharmony in Milwaukee or the United States. They didn't invent the issues that they were weighing in on, but it seems like they tried to, what, go to the extreme on each side when they could?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the other thing, they didn't invent, you know, misinformation on Twitter or social media accounts either. I mean, you know, they're certainly attempting to weaponize it. But I think, you know, the broader lesson here for the public is that to remember that especially even, you know, an account that may present itself as some sort of online news source, if it's making a very substantial claim, like police shot someone in the back, or, you know, activists are plotting to kill the National Guard, people should pause a second and see what evidence there is for that claim before they swallow it.
And since you published the initial story, Jason, you've also written about calls for a federal investigation looking into this. Who's talking about this?
Former Attorney General Eric Holder happened to be in Madison on Friday and, you know, said that he had been really struck by the account and worried, unnerved, concerned about it, and, you know, called for a federal investigation. He felt that there was a potential basis for an FBI investigation there, as well as hearings at the state and federal level. I mean, we'll see if that happens. I think in many cases, the public has seen this issue of Russian interference as being very much a national issue, not something that was present in their own communities. But I think this report and many other examples that I didn't report on but saw in the database, you know, make clear that's not the case. I mean, it's that these operatives in Russia were very sophisticated about drilling down into local news events and use them for their purposes.
Yeah, were you surprised, Jason, when you dug into these and saw that, yeah, as you were just saying, this wasn't just a national story, this was happening in our backyard?
I was, the degree to which they did that, and maybe a little bit as well about the assembly line nature of their operation. You know, that they would, you know, the way in which they were just simply repeating what worked and just sort of a sort of online roadshow, if you will, that they took from community to community.
And Jason, you mentioned there were some things that you hadn't reported on, at least not yet. Are you still mining for this data?
Definitely. I mean, I think what remains to be done is for, you know, other communities, whether, you know, some of these other shootings that were in Ohio, Oklahoma, North Carolina, you know, I think it's incumbent on other local media around the country to dig into this, because, you know, and certainly in other swing states that were competitive politically, it certainly seems like to me these trolls were active in all or nearly all of those states.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Jason Stein, state capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Right now, most of us remember learning plenty of U.S. history in school. Maybe we even studied Wisconsin, too. But what about our cities, our towns? It's easy for local history to get lost in the shuffle. But a new project in Neenah is bringing it to the city's elementary school classrooms. The Neenah Historical Society is putting together a series of booklets for young students detailing the city's most interesting people and places. It's the latest effort by that group to get kids engaged in their community by learning about its past. Jane Lang is the executive director of the Neenah Historical Society. Jane, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, you at the Neenah Historical Society, you're putting together this series of booklets about the city's past for use in schools there. Where did this idea come from?
Well, actually, last year we had been working on putting together a new exhibit, which is called Making a Hometown, Life in Neenah's Progressive Era. And in the process of researching for that and writing it, I kept coming across all these amazing stories of people from Neenah, and I just thought, this is really inspiring. So that was kind of in the back of my mind, but we've been working for years with different teachers in the school district, and one of their biggest complaints to us, or, you know, issues that they're facing, is they just don't have material to teach local history at an elementary level. And so that was a big frustration, and I've been aware of that. And I also had worked with Wisconsin Public TV on the Hometown Stories Project for Neenah Menasha. And working with Becky Marburger from Wisconsin Public Television on the educational part of that, she also asked me, what resources do you have for teachers at an elementary level? And I thought, well, we don't have much, and I better just do something about that and create something for them. So that's kind of where it all has come together.
And now tell us about these booklets. What kind of things are kids going to find out?
So the Discover Neenah series will be three separate booklets. The first booklet will be People You Should Know, the second, Places You Should Know, and the third, Businesses You Should Know. So they'll be learning about some of the interesting people from Neenah's past in the first one. And we really didn't, it's not intended to be, here's our list of the most important people in Neenah. That's not it at all. It's a list of stories that we are aware of. So right there is one thing we can share with students. We can only tell the history that is written down, and we have. So part of the introduction, we talk about that concept, and just, you know, these are stories that we can share because we have them, but there are many other stories that are equally important, and, you know, it's just kind of a good reminder to people of all ages, record your history, record your stories, because that's the only way we can tell our history. So that first booklet focusing on inspiring stories, people you might not have ever heard of, and then people that you, if you live in Neenah, you may have heard their name before.
I want to jump in because I saw a list and some of the descriptions of the people. Can you tell us about some of the people? Because there are some really interesting stories coming out of Neenah.
Okay, we chose 20 different people, and I wanted it to just be a chronological look at as far back as we can tell some of the stories. So we actually start with some Native American people who lived in Neenah. And then we progress into some of the earliest settlers in Neenah. Glory of the Morning, Hopoka, is the first person that we're talking about in the booklet. So way back in the 1700s, we have a woman serving as a chief for the Winnebago or Ho-Chunk tribe in Neenah. So I think that's interesting right there. So that's where we start. And then moving forward, we're talking about just a wide variety of people. William Aylward, being one, arrived in Neenah in the 1850s from Ireland and began working at a foundry, eventually started a foundry. His son started another foundry. That foundry became the Neenah Foundry. And now you can go anywhere in the world, look down at a manhole cover, and see the Neenah Foundry. So just interesting bits and pieces of our history. Arthur Shattuck is another person. People may not be familiar with Arthur Shattuck, but they're familiar with the name Shattuck in Neenah because the middle school is Shattuck Middle School. But who is this Arthur person? And it turns out he's one of the children of F.C. Shattuck, who was one of the founders of Kimberly-Clark. And he went on to become a famous concert pianist all over Europe. And, you know, just these fascinating stories. I find them fascinating.
Yeah.
I hope that the students will as well.
We're talking to Jane Lang, Executive Director of the Neenah Historical Society, about a project to bring local history from the Neenah community into elementary schools there. And Jane, what are you hoping that the elementary school students themselves get out of this?
I just hope that they'll be informed about our history, learn something that they weren't aware of. But for me, I think that local history, when you discover it and gather information about the surroundings that you're living in, it becomes, it's potentially inspiring, but it also helps you to feel a connection to your community that I think all of us crave a connection to community and want to feel like we understand where we are and feel like we're a part of it. So I think that's what my goal is, really, to inspire students to be proud of their community and just feel like they're a part of it, and they can contribute to our community's history just as others have before them.
And I understand this isn't the first time you at the Neenah Historical Society have worked with schools on local history. What have you done in the past, I think, with high schools?
Right. We've, for the past 5 years, I've done a project with high school students called If Neenah's Walls Could Talk. And the impetus for that was I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if we could go back in time and learn about the people who used to work in these downtown businesses? I mean, I just think that would be so much fun, have a business owner from 1900 telling us the story of their place. Well, obviously we can't do that, but we can create that for the future. So that was kind of the goal of that. It's kind of a gift to the future. We've created with the students over 50 individual web pages on all the historic properties throughout town. So you can have an interior tour, a virtual tour of the inside of all of these historic properties in town. You can have an understanding of who's worked there, the timeline of the building. It's just a lot of fun discovering that and then being able to put it out there for the future, because, you know, maybe somebody will want to look back and see what life was like in 2018. So,
and I love that the students themselves helped create these things, right? Does that get them more engaged in understanding than if you just, I guess, lectured about the things?
Oh, definitely. I think it's so much fun for them, and actually a personal knowledge of that. Our son was part of doing one of the projects and he was in high school, and just that whole kind of energy that students get when they get to run around town and discover, you know, something about this or that, and the business owners, and we did residential properties as well, those homeowners were so welcoming to the students. They just invited them in, let them discover things about these different places. So it became just a lot of fun for them to go around their community and discover all these sort of secret places they'd never been in before.
Jane, I got to ask, being with the Historical Society, whether you're working with kids or grown-ups for that matter, do you see just kind of the light bulbs turn on in their eyes as they start to realize the history of these places they might have walked or driven on every day for years?
Absolutely. And actually, we're currently working on another new project with students from the high school and from the art department. What we wanted to do is traffic signal box wraps, you know, the gray boxes on the corners that they're so boring looking, but we thought, you know, let's do a box wrap project with art students. So what they're doing is creating historically themed box wraps. So I've gone into their classes and just making that connection for them with art and our community's history has been so much fun because they can stylize old photos of Nina, make it, you know, beautiful and artistic and engaging and eye-catching for us as we'll travel down the streets. But what they're learning about the community at the same time, I just think is invaluable. And they've been very excited to discover, you know, different parts of our story. So it's exciting.
Jane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Jane Lang is the executive director of the Nina Historical Society. She joined us to talk about a project that brings local history into Nina's elementary school classrooms. Now, the death penalty has been in the news recently as today. The state of Oklahoma recently announced that they want to restart executions of death row inmates. Those had been on hold because of issues with access to the needed drugs for lethal injections. Here's Oklahoma's Attorney General Mike Hunter explaining how the use of nitrogen gas would work.
Well-documented research has shown individuals who are exposed to excessive amounts of inert gas experience fatigue, dizziness, perhaps a headache, loss of breath, and eventual loss of consciousness. If oxygen does not displace the inert gas within the individual's system, in just a few minutes, death will occur. This is the safest, the best, and the most effective method available, and we're moving forward.
And President Trump has said that he sees a role for the death penalty as part of efforts to stem the opioid crisis. Here are remarks he made earlier this month.
We have pushers and we have drug dealers that don't, I mean, they kill hundreds and hundreds of people, and most of them don't even go to jail. You know, if you shoot one person, they give you life, they give you the death penalty. These people can kill 2,000, 3,000 people, and nothing happens to them. And we need strength with respect to the pushers and to the drug dealers. Some countries have a very, very tough penalty, the ultimate penalty. And by the way, they have much less of a drug problem than we do.
The president also made that case for capital punishment in a speech earlier today in New Hampshire, where he unveiled the White House policy on opioid drugs. But is public opinion in favor of increasing or even continuing the death penalty? Darren Wheelock is an associate professor of social and cultural sciences at Marquette University. His research interests include racial and ethnic aspects of public policy, criminology, sociology of law, punishment, and social control. Darren, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Can you talk, Darren, about how widely used capital punishment is in the United States today?
Sure. The trends are pretty clear that levels of executions have gone down in this country fairly considerably over the past 15, 20 years. We saw peaks in the late 90s of some in the neighborhood of 100 executions a year. And in 2016, there were 20, and in 2017, there were 23, which has been the lowest number of executions we've seen in probably almost 30 years.
What are some of the reasons behind that decline in executions?
Well, I just think there's the political will and the public opinion has shifted to other priorities. Criminal justice in general has, I think, as a general topic, been seen as an area where there needs to be reform across the board, with regard to sentencing, with regards to incarceration and mass incarceration as a problem, reentry as a problem, and that public opinion also with regards to capital punishment has shifted considerably.
Now, here in Wisconsin, as a state, we do not have capital punishment. It's a possible penalty at the federal level, and in, I think, 31 states. Have we seen movement in states making more states have capital punishment or fewer states in recent years?
It's been fewer. In fact, I believe in 2016, I want to say Delaware just joined the ranks of states. It dropped from 32 to 31 because of that state. And in the past, I would say 10 years, something in the neighborhood of a half a dozen states have repealed capital punishment statutes. And four states, there's actually moratoriums, gubernatorial moratoriums on moratoria on capital punishment as well. So the trend line is going in the opposite direction that the earlier piece you had on President Trump's call for increased capital punishment.
And President Trump has been mentioning other countries having tougher laws for drug dealers, capital punishment. He's referenced China. He's brought it up in the context of the Philippines, where there's an extrajudicial campaign of capital punishment in effect. How does the United States stack up with the rest of the world when it comes to the death penalty?
Yeah, well, at its recent height in the mid to late 90s, it was somewhere in the top five countries. And the other countries that were also occupied the top spots tend to be places like Iraq, Saudi Arabia. China is an interesting one because we suspect that China executes a large number of prisoners, somewhere in the thousands, but they don't actually publish official reports. But as the United States has started to execute fewer people, it's dropped out of the top 10. But it's still fairly rare relative to countries that it tends to compare itself to more often, countries like Canada and Britain and other countries in the European Union have for several decades now not practiced capital punishment.
Talking to Darren Wheelock from Marquette University about capital punishment in the news as one state, Oklahoma, is moving to resume capital punishment with a new method, and President Trump calling today for more widespread use of the death penalty for opioid drug sales. And Darren, let's get into public opinion. What's the percentage of people supporting it these days? How has that been changing over time?
Yeah. In 2017, there was a Gallup poll. And the Gallup poll showed 55% of respondents supporting capital punishment, which was a drop from 60%, I believe, the year before. And there was a very highly publicized Pew Research survey conducted in 2016. And there were a number of people that reported on that. And that was the first time we've had a survey indicate that support for capital punishment dropped under 50%. And in that particular survey, 49% of respondents reported supporting capital punishment. And that's in fairly significant contrast to, again, the 90s, particularly the mid-90s, support reached as high as 75 to 80%. So we've seen levels for and support for that particular criminal justice policy really declining fairly rapidly over the last 20 years.
We heard from Michael on Facebook, who says he doesn't support the death penalty because it doesn't deter crime and it's more expensive, he says, to keep someone on death row compared to a life sentence. Let's talk about that deterrence angle, Darren. That's been one of the big things people have argued about, and that the president has been making the case. If we're executing particular drug dealers, it'll be a disincentive for other people to do the same crimes.
Yeah, well, I think the majority of criminologists would disagree. There was a survey done of criminologists, and I believe 88% of them reported that they did not believe that it served as a deterrent. And much of the research shows, much of the recent research, I would say, shows that it does not serve as an effective deterrent. There were some earlier studies done in the 70s done by some economists that suggested there could be a deterrent effect. but the bulk of the research lately shows that it is not, it generally does not have a deterrent effect.
We also heard from Krista on Facebook, who says if a person is unquestionably guilty of a crime that seriously harmed an innocent person, Krista says she'd be okay with capital punishment. And that's another common argument about the idea of appropriate moral punishment for someone who's done wrong. Is that something that comes up in public opinion polling much?
It does, but the rub there is that we absolutely know to be guilty is sometimes that in and of itself is difficult to do. You know, criminal court cases are oftentimes contested affairs, and individuals, defendants themselves, may or may not admit culpability or responsibility for their actions. So it's complicated. There was a Wisconsin referendum in 2006, is a non-binding referendum. And in that referendum, electoral referendum, I believe 56% of Wisconsin residents supported capital punishment in cases where there was DNA evidence. And the problem is that many cases do not have DNA evidence. So even in those cases, it can be a bit more complicated.
And are there nuances when we actually have a defendant in a court that are different than when we're thinking in the abstract about crime and punishment, where based on maybe race or gender or other factors, capital punishment affects different groups of people differently?
Yeah, that's one of the fairly salient arguments against the use of capital punishment, is that it is administered unfairly. There's been a number of Supreme Court challenges throughout the years against capital punishment for that very purpose. And in fact, there was a four-year moratorium in 1972. The case was Furman v. Georgia. And in that case, the defendant claimed that capital punishment was administered in a racially disparate or disproportionate manner. The Supreme Court agreed. And then 4 years later, another case came up, and the Supreme Court opened the doors again for it. One of the primary patterns that researchers tend to find is there's inconsistent findings of the race of the defendant, but there are very consistent findings on the race of the victim. When victims are white, prosecutors tend to seek the death penalty far more often than if the victim is not white.
We're talking to Darren Wheelock about the death penalty and where public opinion is on that issue. He's an associate professor of social and cultural sciences at Marquette University. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the capital punishment, support the death penalty, support capital punishment? If you do, why? If not, why not? Would you support President Trump's call for making capital punishment for some drug dealers part of our approach to combating the opioid crisis, as he called for speaking earlier today in New Hampshire? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the death penalty with Darren Wheelock from Marquette University, and you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is the death penalty justified? If so, in what kinds of cases should it be used? Do you think it should be used for more people who are convicted of federal drug offenses, as the president has been calling for as part of his opioid policies he's revealing today? If you're against capital punishment, what do you think is the appropriate way to punish perpetrators of heinous crimes? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Leslie on Facebook says, Darren, that there are cases where measures taken to put someone to death don't work. And Leslie points to things like expired drugs, faulty electric chairs in the past. And that was, it seemed like there was a wave of what people are calling botched executions, Darren, that really maybe changed public opinion. What do you think?
Yeah, there are definitely high-profile instances. Oklahoma has had its fair share, particularly revolving around the use of lethal injection. As one of the, there's a three-drug combination used, and one of those drugs is now become very difficult to secure because it's made in Europe, and Europe has made it difficult to send that drug for the use of executions. And has it helped shift public opinion? I think that's possible. I think there's a number of factors. I think that in some ways, our general understanding of criminal justice over the past 10 to 15 years has shifted. And part of that has definitely been the effectiveness and the use of capital punishment.
Let's go to our callers now. Caleb is with us in Woodstock, Illinois. Caleb, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to comment on possible blowback from the death penalty being applied to these criminal offenses that, you know, before all the criminals, you know, stop being criminals, they're going to have some that are going to be facing a possible execution. I feel that they may endanger or fight harder to not be apprehended if confronted, like at a police raid or a drug bust.
Caleb, thanks for the call. And I've heard that argument made, Darren, that maybe it won't be such an incentive to stop committing crimes, but it would be an incentive, some people have said, to resist arrest as much as possible if you fear capital punishment.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Other people have suggested that perhaps an approach may be not to leave any victims, right, or excuse me, witnesses. You're less likely to want to do that if you think that the consequence for your criminal behavior could be execution. That involves a degree of rationality in the way that criminals generally approach their behavior. And there's some evidence to question the rational capacities of an individual in the specific context of criminal behavior, especially when many of these individuals have drug and alcohol abuse problems and or suffering from mental illness.
Right. This would be a very hard thing, it seems to me, to measure in any reliable way, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Caleb. Paul is with us next in Madison. Paul, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
I've heard that the opioid crisis stems somewhat from the improper distribution of opioid pills, and therefore it's kind of a pharmaceutical, big pharma issue. And it seems maybe the death penalty wouldn't have much of a role in stopping that problem. Could the caller comment on that?
Paul, thanks for the call. Yeah, referring, Paul, there to the prescription side of the opioid epidemic, there is also the illegal heroin and illegal synthetics, illegal fentanyl, things like that. But is the death penalty, Darren, do you think, a possible tool in dealing with the opioid problem, as the president is making the case?
I don't really see the connection there. As the caller mentioned, The root problem of our current opioid epidemic is complicated and could actually come from the distribution of opiates or prescription medication from doctors and the way that that is promoted by pharmaceutical companies. Now, I don't want to speak too much of that because that starts extending into areas beyond my expertise. But to think that capital punishment is going to address the opiate crisis is peculiar. And also I wanted to speak on this notion that he tries to claim that, well, he makes the claim that, you know, the punishments are not currently severe enough for people that are involved in drug offending. And I would actually argue that we have some of the most severe penalties for individuals convicted of drug offenses. In many jurisdictions, individuals can go to prison for decades for drug offenses. When we start talking about deterrence, the issue of severity, I feel like we've kind of maxed out what we can get out of severity as it relates to deterrence.
Thanks for that call, Paul. We're talking to Darren Wheelock, Associate Professor of Social and Cultural Sciences at Marquette University, talking about the politics and public opinion related to capital punishment. We heard from Diane on Facebook. Diane says, as a young person, she was against the death penalty. Now she says she's for it. Diane says, life in prison sounds like a good option to the death penalty until you realize, she says, that the taxpayers are footing the bill. And people have talked about the cost of life in prison and the cost of the death penalty. Can you talk about that, Darren?
Yeah, sure. I think that's a really common misconception, is that people with life, with a sentence of life without parole, actually cost more to taxpayers. And that's actually not true. Most analysis, for example, in Florida, I believe the cost of capital punishment is about six times that of life without parole. And in Texas, in Florida and Texas are two states that execute some of the most people in annually in the United States. And in Texas, I believe the cost of capital punishment is about 3.5 times that of life without parole. And what it's difficult to think about, well, why could that possibly be the case? But the reason why capital punishment tends to be so expensive is because appeals are automatic. And so you get involved in very lengthy legal process once someone is sentenced to death. And so certainly if an individual is willing to increase the chances that an innocent person is executed, we could remove those appeals, something that I certainly would not support. But that's why capital punishment ends up being fairly expensive, is because once you get involved in long legal challenges and in the legal process, then that becomes very expensive.
Thanks for that comment, Diane. Darren, as we start to wind down, there's been a move, I think, from the left and right in this country to say, hey, we're imprisoning too many people, incarcerating too many people. Mm-hmm. Let's move away from a tougher punishment model to more prevention and rehabilitation where we can. And President Trump seems to be moving now back in the opposite direction of that. What do you make of that back and forth?
That's a really interesting question, and one that I've been thinking about for the past few years. Clearly, right before the 2016 election, there was actually a bipartisan bill for federal sentencing reform that was there was a tremendous amount of support, legislative support for it. And then there was some last-minute scrambling that people were uncomfortable with passing that kind of legislation at that time. But there are very vocal critics. For example, Senator Rand Paul is a very vocal critic of mass incarceration. He's a very vocal critic of the war on drugs. And so we've seen certain individuals, conservative political leaders, speaking out against current criminal justice policies. And so it's a very interesting move, a pivot that President Trump has taken to try to return back to these law and order platforms that we had seen throughout the 80s and 90s. I think back then there's been a considerable amount of research to show that a lot of that was politically motivated, and I suspect that we're seeing a similar pattern where that's not really about policy as much as about politics.
We'll leave it there for now, Darren. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Darren Wheelock, Associate Professor of Social and Cultural Sciences at Marquette University. He joins us to talk about recent news about capital punishment and the changing public opinion when it comes to the issue of the death penalty. You can keep the conversation going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.